Blog Talk Radio. Greetings. This is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal, the special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, December 26, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of our program. The program will feature our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the announcement by the Ethiopian government that it has arrested suspects in a plot to destabilize the Horn of Africa state. There were more than 100 people injured during recent protests in the Republic of Sudan, which demanded an immediate transition to civilian democratic rule. Mozambique civilians are requesting additional support from the Southern African Development Community in the fight to end the insurgency in Cabo Delgado. And South African Anglican Bishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu has died in the Republic of South Africa. In the second hour, we look back on two major stories of 2021, the centenary of the Tulsa massacre inside the United States, along with the attempts to destabilize the government of Ethiopia, which has been happening now for more than a year. Finally, we review some of the most pressing and burning issues taking place on the African continent. Stay tuned. This is the beginning of our program. We'll take our musical interlude with music from Northwest Africa among the Tuareg people. This album is entitled Tinariwen. Let's listen in.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You're welcome to the desert.
The
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. Shukran.
You're welcome to the desert. Scenario and people and desert. After you are the Shamu qui vont venir encore.
tinggal, kedek tinggal, zaman kata tinggal. Kalian muha udah harcinta, kalian junta, kalian muda, kalian teriakan, tiada henti hujan.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast, and that was music from the Tuareg people of Northwest Africa, from an album entitled Tino Rewin. And, of course, you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. Our lead story deals with the current security situation in the Horn of Africa state of Ethiopia. The Ethiopia National Intelligence and Service Security Agency just this last past Tuesday disclosed that it has arrested about 164 individuals over alleged involvement in activity to support terrorist groups. 5.8 kilograms of gold and hard currencies from different countries were seized. That's according to a report by the Ethiopian Broadcasting Corporation, which cited a statement sent to it from the NISS. The currency and gold were meant to be used by groups that the Ethiopian Parliament designated as terrorist organizations, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, and the military wing of the Oromo Liberation Front, which the government calls as Shani. 12 of these suspects are linked to an attempt to smuggle out 5.8 kilograms of gold bars through Bole International Airport. The hard currency was wrapped with minced meat to an undisclosed destination. 34,100 British pounds, 27,170 euro dollars, and 6,200 Swiss francs, and 209,750 U.S. dollars, 400 Canadian dollars, 4,058,378 Ethiopian birr, 47,370 euro, 37,330 British pounds again, were seized at Bolo International Airport, as reported by the Ethiopian Broadcasting Corporation. The National Intelligence and Security Services of Ethiopia claims the funds were meant to finance the TPLF and the OLF Shani cells abroad. The objective of some of the suspects seemed to be just meant to smuggle hard currency out of Ethiopia with the intention to harm Ethiopia's economy. And in Sudan, 178 people were wounded by the security forces in Khartoum yesterday as a result of the excessive use of violence to disperse the anti-coup protest. Protesters in Sudan took to the streets to reaffirm their rejection of the dissolution of the transitional government by the military component just 2 months ago on October the 25th. In a statement released late on Saturday, the Central Committee of the Sudanese Doctors said that 178 demonstrators were injured, including 8 by live bullet wounds. 3 of them are of a critical nature. The Sudanese government closed main streets leading to the Republican Palace in Khartoum, shut down internet services. They deployed troops on the bridges linking the 3 towns of the capital of Khartoum, Khartoum North, and Omdurman. 5 days after the last protest on December the 19th, the demonstrators again made their target the presidential palace, which is the premises of the military-dominated Sovereign Council. In spite of the massive deployment of joint security forces, including the police, the army, and the rapid support forces, the protesters marched towards the palace, chanting slogans to denounce the coup d'etat of General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. People are stronger, and it is impossible to go back. They also chanted to voice their determination to continue the protest that started immediately after the first hours of the coup on October the 25th. Women participated in Saturday's demonstration to show they were not intimidated by the sexual violence and rape by the security forces that occurred on December the 19th. The police used live ammunition and tear gas to disperse the protest in the streets near the Republican Palace. Nonetheless, they failed to stop the demonstrations. The security authorities in Khartoum on Friday announced the closure of the bridges and streets leading to the sovereign and strategic sites. the security services will deal with chaos and abuses, said a statement issued by the Security Coordination Committee of Khartoum State. Also, it warned against attacks on sovereign sites. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. In the southern African state of Mozambique, the Southern African National Defense Forces, the South African National Defense Forces spokesperson, Brigadier General Andreas Mahapa, said Mozambican locals were pleading for SADC's intervention to stop insurgents in that country following attacks on communities in the natural gas-rich north region. The South African National Defense Forces soldiers are part of the Southern African Development Community mission in neighboring Mozambique, fighting rebel groups. On Monday, a South African soldier was killed in an ambush. Corporal Deboho Radebe's body was returned to home soil and handed over to his family by army officials. Meanwhile, Mahapa said they had made strides in combating the insurgency in northern Mozambique, saying it was in the interest of SADC nations to act against the attacks. Mahapa said while their stay had been extended to next month, they would await direction from the region on how long they were expected to remain on the ground. And finally, in regard to developments taking place on the continent, Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu has died. South Africans have been urged to honor the legacy of global peace and anti-apartheid struggle icon Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu and also to follow his examples. Tutu passed away at the age of 90 at his home in Cape Town earlier this morning. Described as a lifelong human rights and social justice champion, the Arch lived and preached the values of justice, forgiveness, and equality. He was also famously outspoken. Even after the fall of the apartheid regime, Tutu never shied away from confronting South Africa's shortcomings or injustices. Yet the Arch brought a unique playfulness and was always ready to dance and laugh with an infectious cackle that became his trademark. As friends, family, and supporters remember the life of the Arch, many say he was left a lasting legacy that will help heal the wounds of the South African system. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding this segment of our program, we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in various newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website, and that is at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's to listen to today's program for the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast. Also, to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and that was the voices of the Marvelettes, Motown Sound, Detroit's own Marvelettes, the tune entitled Somewhere, Someday. That, of course, is a tribute to Wanda Young, the former lead singer of the Marvelettes, who made her transition just several days ago. And, of course, the Marvelettes were alumni of Inkster High School, right outside the city of Detroit. And two major issues that, of course, had international coverage during 2021. The first we'll look at, of course, is the centenary of the Tulsa Race Massacre of late May and early June of 1921. The 100th anniversary was commemorated just 6.5 months ago, and we're going to bring you the proceedings of two of the survivors who addressed the United States Congress just in May of this year. And let's listen in on the survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where an estimated 300 African Americans were killed, along with their homes being destroyed, their businesses being burned, and many of whom spent time in detention for merely following through on their own efforts aimed at self-determination. Let's listen in.
Is the microphone on?
Yes. My name is My name is Viola Ford Fletcher. I'm the daughter of Lucinda Ellis and John Wesley Ford of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm the sister of Hughes Van Ellis, who is also here today. I'm a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. 2 weeks ago, I celebrated my 107th birthday. Today, I'm visiting Washington, D.C. for the first time in my life. I'm here seeking justice, and I'm asking my country to acknowledge what happened in Tulsa in 1921. On May 31st in 21, I went to bed at my family's home in Greenwood, neighbors of Tulsa. The neighborhood I felt asleep in that night was rich, not just in terms of wealth, but in culture, community, heritage, and my family had a beautiful home. We had great neighbors, and I had friends to play with. I felt safe. I had everything a child could need. I had a bright future ahead of me. Greenwood should have given me the chance to truly make it in this country. Within a few hours, all of that was gone. The night of the massacre, I was awakened by my family. My parents and five siblings were there. I was told we had to leave, and that was it. I will never forget the violence of the white mob when we left our home. I still see black men seen being shot, black bodies lying in the street. I still smell smoke and see fire. I still see black businesses being burned. I still hear airplanes flying overhead. I hear the screams. I have lived through the massacre every day. Our country may forget this history, but I cannot. I will not, and other survivors do not, and our descendants do not. When my family was forced to leave Tulsa, I lost my chance of an education. I never finished school past the fourth grade. I have never made much money in my country. State and city took a lot from me. Despite this, I spent time supporting the war effort in the shipyards of California. But most of my life, I was a domestic worker serving white families. I never made much money, but to this day, I can barely afford my everyday needs. All the while, the city of this Tulsa have unjustly used the names and stories of victims like me to enrich myself and its white allies through the 30s million, through the 30s million raised by the Tulsa Centennial Commissioner while I was continued to live in poverty. I am 107 years old and have never been seen justice. I pray that one day I will. I have been blessed with a long life and have seen the best and the worst of this country. I think about the terror, horror inflicted upon black people in this country every day. This subcontinent committee has the power to lead us down a better path. I'm asking that my country acknowledge what has been happened to me, the tremors and the pain, the loss, and I ask survivors and descendants to be given a chance to speak, seek justice, open the door. All of you know how easy it is to deny that a violent mob threatened your lives and took your property. For 70 years, the city of Tulsa and its stream of tremors told us that the massacre didn't happen, like we didn't see it with our own eyes. You have me here right now. You see Mother Randall, you see my brother, Hughes Van Ellis. We live this history, and we can't ignore it. It's our lives with us. Oh, my goodness. We lost everything that day, our homes, our churches, our newspapers, our theaters, our lives. Greenwood represented all the best of what was possible for black people in America and for all the people. No one cared about us for almost 100 years. We and our history have been forgotten, washed away. This Congress must recognize us and our history. For black America, for the white Americans, and for all Americans, with that's some justice. Yes, is that it? Thank you.
Do you want to say anything else?
I thought it was another page.
Do you want to say anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you want to say?
No, it's not.
Thank you very much. We appreciate very much your testimony. Mother Fletcher, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. So thank you for putting us on the right course to learn and to understand and to do better.
Thank you.
Are you the older of the two siblings?
The older.
Are you older than your brother here?
Yes.
You are?
Yes.
So he's used to having a tough act to follow. Our next witness is Mr. Hughes Van Ellis, known as Uncle Red.
Yep.
He's a World War II veteran, having served in the United States Army in the China-Burma-India Theater of Operations as a member of an all-black unit. He's also a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Uncle Red, you're on.
Chairman Gorman, Ranking Member Johnson, and member of the subcommittee, my name is Hughes Van Ellis. I am 100 years old. And I am a survivor of the Tulsa Race Massacre. Because of the massacre, my family was driven out of our home. We were left with nothing. We were made refugees in our own County. My childhood was hard, and we didn't have much. We worried what little we had would be stolen from us, just like it was stolen in Tulsa. You may have been taught that when something is stolen from you, you can go to the courts to be made whole. You can go to the courts to get justice. This wasn't the case for us. The courts in Oklahoma wouldn't hear us. The federal courts said we were too late. We were made to feel that our struggle was unworthy of justice, that we were less valued than whites, that we weren't fully Americans. We were shown that in the United States, not all men were equal under law. We were shown that when blacks' voices called out for justice, no one cared. But we still had faith things would get better. We still believe in the promise of America and the cases of freedom. I did my duty in World War II. I served in combat in the Far East with the 234 AAA Gun Battalion. We were all black battalion. I fought for freedom aboard, even though it was ripped away from me at home. Even after my home and my community were destroyed. It's because I believe in the end, America would get its right. When I returned home from the war, I didn't find any of this freedom. I was fighting for overseas. Unlike white servicemen, I wasn't entitled to GI Bill benefits because of the color of my skin. I came home to segregation, a separate and unequal America, but still I believed in America. This is why we are still speaking up today. Even at this age of 100, the Tulsa Race Massacre is a footnote in the history books for us. We live with it every day, and the thought of what Greenwood was and what it could have been. We aren't just black and white pictures on a screen. We are flesh and blood. I was there when it happened. I'm still here.
That's right.
My sister was there with the staff. She's still here. We are not asking for a handout. All we are asking for is for a chance to be treated like a first-class citizen who truly in the pictures of the promise that this is a land where there is liberty and justice for all. We are asking for justice for a lifetime of ongoing harm that was caused by the massacre. We can give us the chance to be hard and give us a chance to be made whole. After all of these years and after all of our struggle, I still believe in America. I still believe in the ideas that I fought overseas to defend. And believe if given this chance, I will do the right thing and justice will be served. Please do not let me leave this earth without justice, like all the others, massacre survivors. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Do you want to say anything else? You want to say anything else?
I want to say that I appreciate being here, and I hope we all will work together. We are one. We are one.
Thank you, Mr. Van Ellis, a.k.a. Uncle Red. The last witness on our panel is coming to us through Zoom, our reasonable facsimile of such, Miss Leslie Benningfield Randall. Mother Randall was 6 years old when she lived through the Tulsa Race Massacre. Mother Randall will be joining us virtually. Mother Randall, you are recognized now.
Good morning, Chairman Cohen.
Good morning.
Ranking Member Johnson and members of the subcommittee, I am blessed and honored to be here speaking with you today. It means a lot to me to finally be able to look at you all in the eye and ask you to do the right thing. I have waited so long for justice. My name is Leslie Evelyn Benningfield Randall. People call me Mother Randall. Today I'm 106 years old. 100 years ago, in 1921, I was a six-year-old child. I was blessed to live with my grandmother in a beautiful black community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, called Greenwood. I was lucky. I had a home, and I had toys. I didn't have any fear. I was a young child, and I felt very safe. Thank you. My community was beautiful and was filled with happy and successful black people. Then everything changed. It was like a war. White men with guns came and destroyed my community. We couldn't understand why. What did we do to them? We didn't understand. We were just living. But they came and they destroyed everything. They burned houses and businesses. They just took what they wanted and out of the building. Then they burned the building, burned them. They murdered people. We were told they just dumped the dead bodies into the river. I remember running outside of our house. I just passed dead bodies. It wasn't a pretty sight. I still see it today in my mind 100 years later. I was so scared. I didn't think we could make it out to alive. I remember people were running everywhere. We waited for the soldiers to come. And when they finally came, they took us to the fairground where we would be saved. It felt like so long before they came. Thank you. Let's see. I survived the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, and I have survived 100 years of painful memories and losses. By the grace of God, I am still here. I have survived to tell this story. I believe that I am still here to share it with you. Hopefully, now you all will listen to us while we are still here. Some more?
Mm-hmm.
The white people who did this to us were filled with so much hate. It is disgusting that they hate us so that they hate us for no reason except that we are black people. We know most of the people who committed these acts and died are dead now. The three of us here today are the only ones left that we know of. But just because these men are probably dead, the city and county of Tulsa, the state of Oklahoma, and the Tulsa Chamber are still responsible for making it right, because it was they who caused the massacre. And it's continued. The Chamber helped ensure that we could not rebuild after the massacre, including holding us in internment camps. They owe us something. They owe me something. I have lived much of my life poor by opportunities. My opportunities were taken from me. And my community, North Tulsa, Black Tulsa, is still messed up today. They didn't rebuild it. They sure did. It's empty. It's a ghetto. They have raised more than $30 million and have refused to share any with me or the other two survivors. They have used my name to further their fundraising goals without my permission. Now that's a crime and misrepresenting my support of their upcoming centennial. Yes, events focused on making Tulsa look good and not just us. You can help us get some justice. America is still full of examples where people in positions of power, many just like you, have told us to wait. Others have told us it's too late. It seems like justice in America is always so slow or not possible for black people. And we are made to feel crazy. Just for asking for things to be made right. There are always so many excuses for why justice is so slow or never happened at all. I am here today, 106 years old, looking at you all in the eye. We've waited 100 years. No, we have waited too long, and I am tired. We are tired. And lastly, I am asking you today to give us some peace. For some peace, please give me, my family, and my community some justice. Thank you.
Welcome back. And that was the testimony of three survivors of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. The centenary took place earlier this year during late May and early June of 2021. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for today, which is Sunday, December 26, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
I'll still be around. And I know
Welcome back. And, of course, Irma Thomas from the city of New Orleans, the legendary Irma Thomas, singing that very important song, Time is on My Side. And another story that we covered and have been covering and continue to cover, of course, is the U.S. and imperialist-backed attempts to destabilize the Horn of Africa state of Ethiopia. And we have been presenting the Ethiopian and Pan-African perspective on the conflict and trying to get to the root of what it is all about and who are the players involved and why they want to destabilize and change and engage in regime change in the Horn of Africa state of Ethiopia, which is the seat of the African Union. We're going to listen to a report from TRT where the spokesperson for the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, that is Bilani Sayoum, answers questions from obviously a Western bias, but this, of course, is what we are dealing with in regard to the situation in Ethiopia, the Horn of Africa, and indeed throughout the African continent and the African world. Let's listen in.
Welcome, everyone. I am Adeshewa Josh, and this is Africa Matters. We begin in Ethiopia, where the government says its forces have retaken a city in southern Tigray just days after rebels announced a retreat from the Amhara and Afar regions. Bilani Sayoum, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's spokesperson, joins me for an exclusive interview from the capital, Addis Ababa. And we go to Nigeria, where kidnapping for ransom is an increasingly common threat. We speak to one family about their traumatic ordeal at the hands of captors. We'll also profile South African women who are changing the landscape of entrepreneurship by building successful businesses. On Monday, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front announced plans to withdraw from the neighboring regions of Amhara and Afar, calling for a ceasefire and talks to end the 13-month civil war. Back in October, the TPLF had called for the withdrawal of federal troops from the regions as a precondition for ending hostilities and negotiating with the government. The government says the TPLF's withdrawal announcement is a cover for military setbacks. But in a letter to the UN, the TPLF leader, Debretsion Gebremichael, said the decision was in response to the unanimous international call to withdraw TPLF troops from neighboring regions. He also asked the Security Council to consider imposing a no-fly zone for hostile flights over Tigray and an arms embargo on the federal government of Ethiopia and Eritrea. In December, the UN Human Rights Council agreed to launch an international investigation into rights abuses allegedly committed by both sides of the conflict. The Ethiopian government and 13 other countries on the council opposed the resolution, saying it's counterproductive and is likely to exacerbate tensions. Meanwhile, the U.S. has welcomed the TPLF's plans to retreat from Amhara and Afar as a step in the right direction.
So, in fact, if we do see a movement of Tigrayan forces back into Tigray, that is something we would welcome. It's something we've called for, and we hope it opens the door to broader diplomacy.
The Ethiopian State Minister Redwan Hussein says officials will begin an inclusive national dialogue that could lead to a referendum and a constitutional amendment. He says the TPLF, which it considers a terrorist organization, is welcome to join under certain conditions.
So if TPLF could like ready to hand over like a bunch of fetish criminals, the central core, and then things might be different. Now it's not for me to tell what might happen, but there are a number of possibilities depending on what might happen in the coming few months and few weeks where our operation would keep on pushing this elementis and how they would also embrace that they are not going to dominate or they are not going to capture at this.
The UN says more than 9.4 million people are at risk of food insecurity in northern Ethiopia, and more than half of them are in Tigray. It remains to be seen if the TPLF will follow through and return its forces to Tigray. But much will also depend on how Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed chooses to respond. Let's hear more from the Prime Minister's spokesperson, Bileni Seyoum. She joins me from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Thank you so much for making out time. I can imagine how busy you are at this time. So my first question will be, are we likely to see peace negotiations involving the TPLF now that it has withdrawn troops from the contested regions?
This is not an engagement of equals, and we've been saying that before. For others, it might be viewed that way, but for the Ethiopian government, for the Ethiopian people, TPLF, as a terrorist organization designated accordingly by the constitution, is a threat to the integrity of the nation as well. So thwarting of that threat has always been a focus, and it's not prerequisite that a designated terrorist organization will bring to the table for dialogue or for negotiations to happen, but the rule of law operations that the government of Ethiopia is mandated to undertake needs to be seen through. So what comes as a result of this clearing process and the prerequisites and the other preconditions for any kind of outcome to or this for
lasting. So Bileni, let me just come in here. So the Ethiopian government will not negotiate with the TPLF, withdrawal or not, and we don't know if this war is officially over.
I don't think it's as simple as putting it as negotiations with a designated terrorist organization is going to bring this war over or not. Like I said, it has been important to safeguard the people of Amhara and Afar regions and the broader Ethiopian from territorial disintegrity that the TPLF have been a culprit to. So at this point in time, like I said, the focus is ensuring that they're cleared out of there. What comes as a result out of that is the onus is again on the TPLF because for the international community, they are saying that they want to undertake a ceasefire, that they want a peaceful resolution. But just 2 weeks ago or even a week ago, they were claiming that they were in the hinterlands or the inner parts of the Amhara region and that they still wanted to move forward. So this disparity in terms of their narrative is something that is not trustworthy. But as far as the Ethiopian government, which is mandated to protect the nation, is concerned, clearing them off totally out of these regions is important. There are other mechanisms that are being put in place to ensure that they do not continue to be a threat to the peace and stability of the country.
Let me come in here, Bileni. I hear you loud and clear. There will be no negotiations with the TPLF. But, you know, some in the international community want accusations of rights abuses by both government and Tigray forces investigated by an independent team led by the UN. This is what Nada Arnashef, the UN Deputy Commissioner for Human Rights, had to say about that resolution. Let's listen.
The onus is on the state to discharge its primary responsibility to deliver fair and independent proceedings that address the full range of violations identified, not only isolated individual instances, and to take into consideration applicable command responsibility. Without significant accountability efforts, an international mechanism could be an important complement.
Can the Ethiopian government be trusted to conduct a free and fair investigation into the allegations and hold perpetrators to account, even if it stands accused?
I need to backtrack a little bit and ensure that there is clarity because there are, I don't want it to be outside, to be construed as the Ethiopian government or the Ethiopian people not wanting a peaceful resolution to this. But there are certain preconditions that the Ethiopian government will put forward when it's due time. Now, responding to your question in terms of is the Ethiopian government willing and committed to an independent investigation, this is a track record that the Prime Minister has set forth early in the conflict as well. Rightly, when you had also introduced earlier, the human rights entity or responsible body within the UN had initiated these independent investigations together with the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission sometime in March, which by November they had concluded and provided the results, which did also hold accountable, yes, certain elements of the government forces for having committed human rights abuses. The Prime Minister and the Ethiopian government accepted this with reservations and facilitated or created a joint mechanism or an interministerial task force was also launched to look into the recommendations that had been forced through this recommendation. So that commitment is there. The commitment has never wavered, and the Ethiopian government has got nothing to hide in this regard.
Right. But Bileni, the question is, if you stand accused, I mean, if the federal government, federal forces stand accused, as well as the TPLF, do you not think it's important to recuse yourself and allow an independent team? Now, where they come from is up to both the government and the regional organizations and perhaps the international community, talking about the UN and your Western allies, to decide who leads these investigations. But do you think that the Ethiopian government should still lead an investigation into an allegation that touches on its conduct throughout this war?
The Ethiopian government has not been involved in undertaking this investigation. The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission is an independent body. As part of the democratization process that Ethiopia embarked on 3 years ago, it was inherent to the way that the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission was restructured outside of TPLF's influence before, which was partisan to the TPLF's meanderings and will. But the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission is independent of the government, so we should not misconstrue it as a body that is subservient to the federal government.
You agree with me, this is a great time to support the people who actually haven't contributed to this war, but they are suffering the most.
They have been supported, and let's not make it seem that the people of Tigray are being punished by the...
I'm not referring to just the Tigrayans. I'm talking about the 9.4 million people, not just in northern Tigray, but also, as you have mentioned, in Afar and Amara, just the people who need humanitarian aid, the people in the middle of this political crisis, this crisis.
Yeah, assistance is being delivered, and we have to take note. I mean, this is something that we've been continuously providing updates on, including from the UN, and they have also been providing updates in terms of movement of trucks within the Tigray region, assistance for the affected individuals and communities within the Afar and the Amhara regions as well. There is still a requirement for a lot of partners to come on board and ensure that those beneficiaries who are in dire need of humanitarian assistance all across the board are sufficiently provisioned in this regard as well. So the government also from its covers has been allocating a lot of funds, has been buying a lot of assistance materials, and has been at the forefront of, providing this assistance. And not only the government, but average Ethiopians within the country, Ethiopians within the diaspora as well, who have been mobilizing resources to support this end.
Well, thank you so much, Bileni Seyoum, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's spokesperson. We have more stories coming up for you here on African Matters, including...
I am Palum David. I'll take a look at Nigeria's booming kidnapping industry and ask what, if anything, is being done to put an end to it.
Since Burundi gained independence in 1962, the East African nation has been plagued by ethnic violence, long simmering tensions between the country's two main ethnic groups. The Hutus and the Tutsis boiled over in 1972. It's estimated that between 100,000 and 300,000 Hutu people were killed in a shocking massacre. Now, Monday, a Burundi government commission found that the massacre of Hutus by the then Tutsi-dominated government was indeed an act of genocide. Kubra Hakoch has the story.
The 1972 mass killings in Burundi is described by some as the darkest chapter of history for the East African nation. And now the final findings of a Burundi government commission, which was set up in 2018 to investigate the killings, have been released.
The group ethnically Hutu,
considering all the data, witness testimonies and laws, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission qualifies what happened in 1972 and in 1973 as a crime of genocide committed against the Hutu people.
The commission also says crimes against humanity had been committed against ethnic Tutsis during the same period. The commission's chairperson says after 3 years of investigation, the commission has found remains of 19,000 people in 200 mass graves. Burundi, a former German colony, was under Belgian rule until 1962 when it gained its independence. But the country has been rocked by ethnic tensions and civil war ever since. tensions flared in 1972 when the Tutsi-dominated government and army carried out a series of mass killings against Hutus. It is believed between 100,000 and 300,000 people were massacred. Witnesses who gave evidence to the Burundi Commission say that every night in the months of May and June in 1972, Hutus who were serving time in prison were put in trucks and sent to the banks of the Ruvubu River where they were killed and dumped in pits. But the Commission's finding has sparked controversy many times before and has been accused of leaning towards one ethnic group. Some Tutsi politicians say these latest findings are one-sided and that the violence was mutual. Kübra Akkoç, TRT World.
Nigeria is experiencing what some are calling a kidnapping epidemic. Most severe in the north of the country, it has now spread to other regions and the government is under increasing pressure to address the issue. It's estimated around 2,000 people have been kidnapped across the country this year. And while many have been released, some never return home. In this report, Pulum David takes a look at how people in Nigeria are coping.
Gunmen broke into the home of 9-year-old Divine Ubom in Nigeria's capital Abuja in November. They kidnapped the sleeping boy along with his 16-year-old sister Ayo and their mother. The kidnappers demanded a ransom of more than $700,000, but fortunately, they were rescued after 2 days by security operatives without paying a cent. The young boy says his experience with the kidnappers was extremely traumatic.
My legs were all sore. I almost became blind because all these pointy plantations have entered this eye. So when they now entered the eye, my eye was not doing me like this. So it was now pain. So my legs became sore. So I was not walking slowly. I was not leaving. Now I said, Muje, now pointed gun at my neck. I said, if you don't walk, I'll shoot you here.
Little Divine says he now lives in constant fear.
Like, if bandits can come to your own house at the middle of the night, enter your own house, carry out of your own gunmen out of your own house in the middle of the night, I'm living in fear.
Divine's mother, who was also abducted, says she's yet to recover from the shock. She reveals that the kidnappers also stole from them.
They took money, they took phones, they took laptops, they even carried the school bag. I wish they had even left the books inside.
The freedom with which kidnappers and gangs are operating within Nigeria is causing widespread anger and panic. Many are accusing President Buhari's administration of failing to address the situation.
The Nigerian police force say more than 1,200 kidnapping victims have been rescued this year, but hundreds of people are still in the hands of abductors, while 1,450 suspected kidnappers have been arrested this year.
What is your work? Me, I can car.
I can nothing.
He said he's a kidnapper.
27-year-old Musa Ibrahim confessed that he kidnapped six people while wearing a fake military uniform and demanded about $1,500 in ransom. Analysts believe that rising unemployment and ransom payments by families and local governments are making kidnapping a lucrative business for some. Nigerian police spokesperson Frank Umba says, aside from making these arrests, they have also intercepted thousands of weapons.
Within this year under review, we recovered a total of 1,787 assorted weapons. And I'm not just talking of locally fabricated weapons. I'm talking of AK-47, AK-49, and other weapons in the Kalashnikov family, including general purpose machine guns. We also recovered over 41,000 rounds of live ammunition.
Kayode Bolaji, a security analyst, believes that the Nigerian police need to do more in stamping out these kidnapping gangs.
They are deficient in several ways: lack of technology, lack of manpower, lack of adequate training to be able to assess some of these facilities where these bandits and kidnappers are. So in general, we will need to look for new ways to tackle the issue of banditry, kidnapping and crime generally in Nigeria.
Until then, hundreds more families are at risk of forcefully being taken away from their homes to face the ordeal that 9-year-old Divine, his sister and mother did. Pulum David, Africa Matters, Abuja.
You're watching Africa Matters, and here's a roundup of other stories making news across the continent. A fight broke out in Ghana's parliament with several lawmakers throwing punches during a debate on a proposed electronic payment tax. The controversial bill would impose a 1.75% e-levy on mobile money transactions. The opposition has delayed passing the national budget since last month over the measure. Critics say the levy will hit lower-income people who rely heavily on mobile money transfers. In Nigeria, health authorities have destroyed more than 1 million expired COVID-19 vaccine doses. The head of the National Healthcare Development Agency has blamed vaccine nationalism in developed countries for hoarding supplies and only donating them when they are about to expire. Nigeria has seen a rise in shipments, but it's facing logistical challenges and vaccine hesitancy. And thanks to conservation efforts, mountain gorillas in Rwanda have been removed from the endangered species list. Their population at the Volcanoes National Park in Rwanda has grown into the hundreds, so much that the park is running out of space. The Rwandan government is planning to move around 4,000 farming households starting next year in order to extend the wildlife area. Despite a lack of capital, women are changing the rules of entrepreneurship in South Africa. According to the World Bank, only 3% of all early-stage investment in Africa in the last 8 years went to female-led startups. And because of historic disadvantages, the numbers are lower for black women. Nsepeng Otema reports from Johannesburg.
Mo Mukoni is on a routine site visit to one of her workshops. These craftsmen are completing the latest orders just in time for the holiday season. Mukoni runs a home decor company making ethical and sustainable houseware products. Some of its best sellers are laundry bins and planters made from recycled PVC water pipes salvaged from landfills and construction sites. She started the company with her sister in 2016 using their savings and haven't received any financial backing since.
We get to where we are in all the retail spaces by calling, by cold calling, by emailing, by following up every day. I mean, I have a target for myself where I send 50 emails a day.
In addition to their online store, the products are now sold by some of the biggest retailers in South Africa and the United States. A few months ago, at their warehouse, the Mokoni sisters proudly packaged up a shipment for a major international client, the upscale American retail chain Crate & Barrel. But the pair says even with deals like those, the growth of their company is being held back by a lack of funding.
There's so many offers that we had to decline because we were not able to meet demand in terms of capacity, in terms of sustaining the production of whatever order it was.
According to the World Bank, although more than half of South Africa's population is female, only 34% of small and medium-sized enterprises are owned and operated by women.
Women here struggle with less access to capital and fewer assets than their male counterparts. Not owning property makes it harder for them to offer collateral for business loans. At the same time, South Africa mirrors the rest of the world when it comes to the low number of women working in the technology sector.
Entrepreneur Mukuni Rambani is continuously working on ways to improve her product. She is the founder of Ambani Africa, an educational app that teaches young children in African languages. She's also one of the few black women in the educational tech sector to have received significant seed funding.
The initial funding, whatever grant funding, whatever investment you can get is quite important and is really the difference between a business that can have longevity and a business that can make it and one that can't, particularly in this technology space where you do in fact need to be able to build certain technology in order to put it out there.
One of Lambani's favorite things to do is to explore the app with her nephew. She launched it in January as a gaming platform promoting the use of local languages. With access to funding, it's now grown into a multifaceted teaching resource that's attracting users of all ages around the world. The 33-year-old says for women-led businesses to receive better support from investors, more of those venture capitalists need to be women.
not only in business do we need that change, but I think also in the VC space, the people that are selecting the businesses that get to be invested in, I think it's important that we also have women representing or representation in that space as well.
That way, as South Africa and the African continent continue to see a boom in startups, the women who own them won't get left behind. Ntebe Motema, Africa Matters, Johannesburg.
This week we go to Southern Africa and explore the town of Maun, often called the tourist capital of Botswana. That's because it's a transit hub into some of the most popular safari destinations on the continent. Let's take a closer look. That's our show this week. Please share your thoughts and suggestions about the stories you've seen on this episode or ideas of stories you would like us to cover on Twitter using the hashtag Africa Matters. Feel free to reach out to me on my personal handle at @AdeshawaJosh and please watch us on YouTube. We'll leave you with these images from across the continent.
Welcome back, and that was Africa Matters discussing the situation in Ethiopia as well as Nigeria and other countries on the African continent. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, December 26, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and that's the voice of Alice Clark from the tune entitled Keep It Hit. And right now we want to move into Africa Live from CGTN, discussing some of the most pressing and burning issues taking place on the African continent. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Bodies of 27 migrants wash ashore in Libya. Sudanese protesters opposed to ministry's rule call for free elections. And South Africans and world figures mourn the loss of Desmond Tutu. Welcome to Africa Live on CGTN with me, Beatrice Marshall, in Nairobi. Also coming up on the program, China's Shenzhou 13 astronauts conduct a second extravehicular activity. And demand in Nigeria is rising for woven cane baskets amid holiday season. Humanitarian agencies in Libya are reporting the discovery of 27 bodies of Europe-bound migrants that have washed ashore in western Libya. The bodies were found in the coastal town of Qoms in two separate locations. Three other migrants have been rescued as search efforts continue. The International Organization for Migration says it has recorded over 160 deaths this month after migrants drowned in two separate incidents off the coast of Libya. According to the United Nations Migration Agency, about 1,500 migrants have perished in shipwrecks in the central Mediterranean route this year. Well, let's cross over to CGTN's Adel Mahroui. He's in Cairo for us. Adel, what more can you tell us about the bodies of the 27 migrants washing ashore in Libya?
Well, so far it has risen up to 28 bodies found across shore of Libya. That's about in a place called Al-Als, which is about 90 kilometers east of Tripoli in the northern part of Libya in the Mediterranean Sea. And the search and rescue mission is still ongoing. However, it is believed that the bodies of these people may be attributed to an earlier incident about 3 or 4 days ago when the IOM confirmed the death of about 160 migrants who crossed their boats capsized and they were not found. According to the initial visual inspections of the bodies found, the initial report says that they most probably have been in the sea for some time, as some signs of impact and decay have been quite evident, which makes it most probably related to the earlier incident about the 160 migrants. However, further investigations are still on way.
Adel, could you tell us more about the search and rescue efforts that you've mentioned?
Well, the search and rescue effort is quite challenging at this time of the year in the northern hemisphere of the earth, where in the Mediterranean Sea, this is a fall season moving into the winter season, so it is quite turbulent in the Mediterranean Sea, and this is usually the most deadly period that we've seen throughout the old year activity of illegal migration and the attempts to cross the Mediterranean from Libya and Tunisia into Europe, into southern Europe. And therefore, the rescue mission is quite challenging. At night, it becomes almost impossible for them to conduct any operation, and therefore, it pauses and moves on. But the rescuers believe that in the coming days, as the tides of the Mediterranean have thrown away some of the bodies toward that area of Libya, that they expect to find more in the next day. Now, this is not just a first-of-its-kind incident. We know that illegal migration in general has been quite a challenge, specifically from Libya into Europe. Just in the week from the 12th to 16th to 18th of December, IOM says they have intercepted and rescued about 466 migrants. Now, these were the lucky ones. Overall, about 30,000 attempts have been registered by the IOM, where they have intercepted and managed to push migrants back where they find themselves detained in Libya and live under dire situations.
Adel Mahoui joining us there from Cairo. Oh, thank you. The crew of the Shenzhou 13 have finished conducting their second spacewalk on the China space station. Senior Colonel Yeo Guangfu left the COMIC module first. Mission Commander Zai Shihang followed around an hour later. And this time, Wang Yangping was supporting them from inside the station. So far, the main task of the extravehicular activities has been completed. The three crew members have been in orbit since October the 16th and will stay in space for a total of 6 months.
It's their last big assignment this year for the Shenzhou 13 crew, and it's also their second EVA activity. And this time, Taikonaut Ye Guangfu and Zhai Zhigang were out, while Wang Yaping stayed in. And for the pair out of the core module, their assignment included some heavy lifting, including putting up and installing a panoramic camera and installing a key component for the mighty robotic arm, and testing out a synchronized collaborative lifting with precision unprecedented. Now, the space engineers here at the Beijing Control Center tell us they were able to ace all of those movements because a lot of times for the key movements, they've practiced at least a dozen times down on the ground. And also another thing was noticed here at the Ground Control Center, the longer the crew stayed up there in space, the more relaxed and kind of like chilled they are. Today and this time around, we heard the taikonauts joked around with people here at the Ground Control Center. And of course, we heard that famous mantra, I am out and I'm feeling just fine. And we certainly hope and we are expecting that they will be feeling fine the rest of the year and in 2022. Sun Ye, CGTN at the Beijing Control Center.
The International Space Station is expected to retire by 2024, so the CSS could soon be the only one in orbit. But China has promised to share its station with the rest of the world, especially developing countries. CGTN's Sheng Yibing looks at what the future has in store.
One question to ask is, will it replace the existing International Space Station known as the ISS? Well, the latter has been in orbit for over 20 years. It's a multinational project that has contributed greatly to our scientific understanding of space. But it may have to retire after 2024. If true, China's space station could be the only one in orbit for a sustained period of time. So it's very likely to play an increasing central role in future science-related research. Another question is, would it be like the ISS and receive international astronauts? Well, back in May 2018, China, together with the United Nations Agency for Outer Space Affairs, invited all UN members to conduct scientific experiments on the new space station, especially developing countries. So in this sense, the new space station will be shared by many more countries, acting as an outpost. Some say this is because China was once excluded from the ISS, so it fully understands the needs and desires of other countries. So within a year, 42 proposals were put forward by 27 countries for the first group of tests. 9 were chosen and they are being prepared once the station is put into use around 2022. Training exchanges between astronauts from the European Space Agency and China National Space Administration have already begun. Russia plans to cooperate with China in this field and on lunar basis as well. When faced with the vast and mysterious universe and huge expenses and risks that come with exploring space, no one can work alone. Coming next, 2 of the remaining 8 assembly missions for China's space station will carry the lab modules through the space station. And there will also be 3 more robotic resupply flights, not to mention 3 more crewed missions during the outpost phase of construction. So there is a lot to look forward to in terms of performance and other contributions to the joint exploration of space by all human beings. Zhang Yibing, CGTN, Beijing.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese protesters rallied near the presidential palace in the capital Khartoum on Saturday, demanding soldiers go back to the barracks. It was the 10th major demonstration since the military took power in October. Protesters say they want the military out of the government during a transition to free elections. Soldiers fired tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. Communications were cut off and major roads and bridges were blocked. Officials say 58 police personnel were injured in the protest and more than 100 people were arrested. So far, at least 48 people have died in crackdowns on the demonstrators.
We will not go out in favor of a party or in favor of freedom and change. We will remain in the street unless our demands are fulfilled. And our demands are that the Burham leave and the rapid support militias be dissolved and returned to the barracks, and the army becomes a national army.
Rejecting murder, oppression and violence, we went out today and we will go tomorrow demanding a civil and democratic state in which we'll be free and live in dignity. The weapon of rape shames the rapist. It does not defeat us, does not break us, and we will not retreat.
Meanwhile, a strategic expert and a political analyst in Sudan say that imposing security measures will calm things down by reducing the friction from direct confrontation. And protesters in Khartoum and other cities need leaders to help them reach their goals.
I think that the security measures taken by the security services are aimed at preventing a recurrence of what happened on the 19th of December, so that there will be no costing lives for the young people, for the procedures, for the dispersal from the front of the Republican Palace. Therefore, I think that it will be useful in preventing injuries and reducing friction between the security services and the demonstrators.
These demonstrations need leadership in order to reach their goals. In their current way, they cannot achieve the desired goals, because a demonstration in the end must have leadership and a roadmap to achieve the goals, which is the full restoration of civil authority, and it is expected that these demonstrations will continue until decisions are reached or political settlements. The demonstrations in the street cannot reach the goal unless there is a political force that crystallizes these demonstrations in a clear roadmap and arrives at inevitable results.
South Africans are mourning the death of Christian clergyman and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He died at the age of 90 on Sunday in Cape Town after battling with cancer. CGTN's Ashtatal brings us the story.
A unifying symbol for all African freedom fighters. This is a description of Desmond Tutu from the Norwegian Nobel Institute, a statement that South Africans agree with.
Thank you for being with us.
It's actually very sad, and I don't think not only for South Africa, but for Africa as a continent. We have lost a great icon, a father, a human who was there not just for the South African people, but for Africa as a nation, Africa as a unit, Africa as one.
Any death is a sad death, actually. I mean, like, if we're losing our leaders like this, our elders, it's always sad. It's never easy. So I'm very saddened about his death.
Stephen Gish, the author of a biography on Tutu, regards him as South Africa's Martin Luther King. Tutu also maintained a presence in the international community, taking part in mediation efforts from Kenya to as far as the island of Cyprus. His memory as a brave and authoritative leader will forever be ingrained in those who knew him.
I feel very, very, very down emotionally right now, because he was somebody that almost everybody liked, especially the kids. They love him.
We're very sad.
Very sad. It was a real shock to us. He's been
a great man.
Yes, somebody to look up to. And we're really going to miss him.
In recent years, Tutu was hospitalized several times due to infections associated with cancer treatment. President Cyril Ramaphosa says his demise marks another chapter in bidding farewell to those who have handed down to the nation a liberated South Africa. Asatal, CGTN.
You're watching Africa Live. Still ahead on the program. Demand in Nigeria is rising for woven cane baskets amid holiday season. And China marks 40-day countdown to Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics.
So this is it. I'm just about to be shot.
Tents here. Bottles are being thrown as they do so.
There are about three critical bridges here in Malawi.
That's one of them. We're going to cross that bridge.
As you can see behind me, police forces
who are replying with gas. Gas just came in.
I can hear gas. So it's all begun now.
Divisions leading the charge into West Mosul have brought us here.
Just got to be careful here with some gunshots.
This is where most of the fighting has been concentrated.
It's the front line now after 9 days of fighting.
We're about 2 to 3 kilometers from the front line.
Within clear view of this front line position.
In Nigeria, cane craft artists and entrepreneurs are cashing on the Yuletide rush. The high demand for woven cane baskets comes with the season's gift-giving traditions. The once-dying craft has now come alive as artists express creativity with the cane baskets in varying shapes and sizes. CGTN's Kelechi Emekalam reports.
40-year-old Peter Robinson is popularly known as the King of Cane for his artistic dexterity in the craft. Weaving with gusto, he's doubling his efforts to finish clients' orders for these bespoke cane baskets. Robinson started Cane Craft over 3 decades ago. He was barely 7 years old. Now it's peak period this Yuletide and his craft is finally paying off. He rakes in nearly 20% in profits. He credits it to his artistic prowess.
When you do a good job, the job sells itself. There is good profit in this job, especially if your work is good and people in Abuja like and will patronage a neat job anytime.
Robinson has a growing customer base. Adeola Nganje is one of those who patronize him. She runs Happy Hampers, a gift packaging business that's bolstering this Yuletide. Depending on the size and items, a hamper could cost between $45 and $250, and for exotic gifts, it costs even more.
The cane baskets are more durable, they are flexible. You know, they are resistant to the weather, whether rain or heat. And, you know, you can use them even after giving the gift. Even after having the gift, it can still be used for household use to store things. If you are doing like 15 to 20 hampers, on an average, you can make like 15% profit on each basket. So it's a very good business. Since the beginning of the holiday season, that's since the beginning of December, I've made like 10 to 15 per week.
Cane craft is a major expression of artistry in Nigeria, passed down from generations. Chairs, tables, stools and other attractive home furniture items are created from cane. Cane artists like Peter Robinson believe that with government support, Nigeria can make revenue from exports.
I'm hoping that we can start exporting this cane craft because the Western world needs cane. If the government supports us, there is a huge opportunity to do better on this craft.
We can do more than better than this for this our work.
All materials from cane craft are sourced locally, and it's helping many like Peter Robinson and Adeola Nganje not only earn a living, but create job opportunities for others. Kelechi Emekalam, CGTN Abuja, Nigeria.
There are 40 days left until the Beijing Winter Olympics, and Beijing has held an event attended by famous Chinese athletes to promote winter sports. The country's athletes have been getting ready for the games for months now. The national ice hockey team, for example, has just finished training in Russia. Leaders of different countries are expected to attend the opening ceremony. Russian President Vladimir Putin will be there in person. The president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, says the games will bring the world together in the spirit of peace, friendship and solidarity. Olympic officials and athletes from other countries say they look forward to Beijing 2022.
We
through Olympics, through the Olympic ideals, we bring everyone together. And I think in this time, in COVID time, it's really, really important to have Olympic Games.
I just returned from the World Cup. I will check out others' performances and flaws through the videos, and also mine. I've trained day and night. We still have 40 days left. I feel good.
I'm eager to see it live with my own eyes and take some pictures and present it to the whole world how nice venues you have made.
Well, final preparations and testing continue at all the venues for the Beijing Winter Olympics. Feng Yile has this report from Shangjiakou, Hebei Province, which will host the snow event.
With Beijing Winter Olympic Games around the corner, the co-host city of Zhangjiakou is set to hold its final week of training and stress tests. It will mark the completion of pre-game testing for all venues at Zhangjiakou's Guyangshu cluster, the National Ski Jumping Center, the National Cross Country Skiing Center, and the National Biathlon Center.
In the final month or so, we will strive to improve the temporary facilities of the venues. For example, we have finished the snowmaking on trails and are now making snow to create a beautiful environment of ice and snow. And there's still work to be done on the Olympic broadcasting services.
The newly built National Ski Jumping Center is now a landmark. It is China's first ski jumping site that meets international standards. Officials say they have done everything they can to ensure the safety of athletes while protecting thousands of trees on the mountains.
The construction of the National Ski Jumping Center requires most work of all venues. Designers and workers have overcome high technical difficulties, and the facilities are undergoing final adjustments for the Winter Olympic Games.
During the test events, we noticed some problems with, for example, doorknobs and heating. These are all minor problems. Our operation team has been communicating with the International Snow Federation and other international organizations. The feedback we've got suggests they're very happy with the whole venue.
The newly built National Cross-Country Skiing Center in Zhangjiakou will host the cross-country skiing and Nordic combined event. Its facility manager says more than 90% of the work here is done, and they've taken action to deal with risks brought by the pandemic.
Our work is centered around the athletes. All relevant staff need to be 2 meters from the athletes, and we have set up preventive fences. In order to protect the safety of the spectators, we have canceled some standing room in the auditorium.
The Genting Snow Park is the only venue that's been adapted from an existing ski resort. It will host some 20 skiing and snowboarding events. The trails that have been reshaped for different events can be repurposed.
The site will continue to function as a public ski resort after that. We can reduce the difficulty of the trails through reshaping so that people can also use the Olympic trails. Likewise, we can also add difficulty through reshaping to hold other international competitions.
Other non-competition facilities that are getting ready include the Winter Olympic Village, the Mountain Press Center, and high-speed transport links from Beijing to Zhangjiakou. These will also be used for other events when the Olympics are over. Feng Yili, CGTN, Zhangjiakou.
We continue with Winter Olympics news. China's foreign ministry has urged Japan not to politicize sports in response to Tokyo's announcement that it will refrain from sending a government delegation to the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing in February. Tokyo has instead opted to send some officials with direct ties to the Olympics. Tokyo's decision follows a US-led diplomatic boycott of the Games. China did not send a government delegation to the Tokyo Summer Olympics this year, but only a sports delegation led by the Sports Bureau Chief.
China welcomes the Japanese Olympic Committee, other relevant persons and Japanese athletes to participate in the Beijing Winter Olympics and Paralympics. We have noted the relevant remarks from the Japanese government. We hope and urge the Japanese side to implement China and Japan's commitments to support each other's Olympic Games and not to politicize sports.
China is confident that it can work with all parties to realize a more united Olympic spirit and present a simple, safe and exciting Olympic Games to the world.
Well, African basketball had a milestone in 2021 as the continent continued to recover from the global pandemic. Three major competitions were held as several youth basketball programs tipped off around Africa this year. CGTN's Mohamed Abubakar looks back at a renaissance year in the sport.
Basketball bounced back with force across Africa in 2021. The epicenter of the action was at the majestic Kigali Arena in Rwanda that hosted the inaugural Basketball Africa League in May. This is the flagship club basketball competition that involves zonal champions across the continent. Powered by the revered American NBA and world governing body FIBA, the BAL showcased the depth of local talent the sport has in Africa.
Basketball in general in Africa is on the way up, and I think we got to be excited for it. And I think our players have done their best to get better. I think now the pressure is on us and the rest of the leaders to really step up and not let our players down. We've shown that the talent is there, you know, and now when you go across Africa and the game is growing, now we've got to grow everything else. We've got to grow the facilities. We've got to, you know, focus on how do we make the game better.
Rwanda's capital was yet again home to the 30th edition of the FIBA Men's AfroBasket in August. The competition, which was celebrating its 60th anniversary, was an unforgettable tournament. Despite Tunisia defending their title, it was the East African teams that won everyone's hearts. Debutants South Sudan reached the quarterfinals, Kenya and Uganda made the pre-quarters, while the host nation left a lasting impression.
And Rwanda has been so stable, not only having a good team, but basically carrying the torch and the flag for Africa right now. And to be a part of that in East Africa has been amazing. And I think there's other countries that I really believe have the talent, you know, Burundi, Somalia. I really believe that the talent is there. It's just about getting it together and organizing. There's a lot of players that I know from those countries that can play basketball.
The FIBA Women's AfroBasket in Yaounde, Cameroon, capped off a busy year for the sport. Nigeria beat Mali in the final to win their third successive title.
We need to still promoting the women in basketball. The women are very important in our society, specifically in Africa. You know the cultural problems that we have. So this is our main objective, is to look for the woman.
FIBA Africa also tipped off an elite youth camp program led by NBA and FIBA experts to further develop young players in Kenya, Senegal and Cote d'Ivoire. The program will continue across other countries in Africa in 2022. Mohamed Abubakar, CGTN.
In African football news, Barcelona's teen sensation Abdes Samad
Welcome back, and that was Africa Live from CGTN. And our concluding segment will be also from CGTN, Africa Talk, the panel discussing some of the important issues taking place on the African continent during 2021. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Despite some signs of hope, the world still remains in the grips of the COVID-19 pandemic. The world is also dealing with the seemingly accelerating pace of climate change. From vaccine nationalism to environmental impact, Africa has borne the brunt of this crisis. Organizations such as the UN and the World Health Organization have joined South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa in pushing for a lifting of COVID-19 vaccine IP rights. Yet, as we head into year three of this pandemic and the world is in the grips of another variant, there seems to be little movement on this front. The climate summit in Glasgow brought little back in the form of climate finance, which is key for developing countries looking to turn green. Africa has been hard hit by the climate change crisis. Extreme weather events such as floods and droughts have battered the continent. In matters of security and politics, 2021 was a roller coaster year for the African continent. From coups across West Africa to conflicts breaking out in the Horn of Africa, it was a year of major shifts. Yet, a new leader in America and a UN General Assembly meeting that marks the return of a multilateral system battered by several years of European nationalism. A reassuring partnership with China in the fight against the pandemic as the CPC celebrates its centenary and the year end to the Focus Summit in Dakar, Senegal. On this week's episode of the program, we look into existing challenges caused by the pandemic. We take a look at the economic and security situation on the continent, as well as the impact of climate change. So what lessons will Africa take from 2021 as it embraces yet another new year? And what can the continent expect in 2022? I'm Beatrice Marshall. Welcome to Talk Africa. Let's now bring in our panel of experts, all joining via Zoom from Johannesburg, Dr. David Monyae, an international relations and foreign policy expert. In Beijing, Professor Xia Lu, associate professor of School of Marxism Studies, Renmin University of China. In Bangui, Dr. Ngoy Nsenga, COVID-19 incident manager for the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Africa, and in Mombasa, Kenya, Mustafa Ali, co-founder and chairman of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies. Gentlemen, a warm welcome and thank you very much for joining in on Talk Africa today. Dr. Nsenga, if I may start off with you, it has been quite an eventful year. Many still unexpected things have happened. What's your take on the key moments that stood out for you in 2021?
Of course, the key event, public health-wise, is the COVID-19, which we're still battling and which will, I believe will continue even beyond 2021 and maybe even beyond 2022. That we have tools, at least we have tools, and by tool I mean especially the vaccine, even though the distribution of the vaccine globally is not what we'd expect, but I think in Africa we are also making progress, even though the progress are still very, very slow, and the progress is still very low in terms of vaccination and reaching all the people. But I believe we are getting there, and I also believe that if there is nothing else which compromises the vaccination, which I'm thinking here about new variant,
right,
I think we'll also in Africa get rid of COVID when it comes time.
Dr. Monyae, the key moments that stood out for you?
There were quite a lot of moments. As my colleague has mentioned, the COVID, which is a negative, played a negative part in Africa's development. But there was also a positive element of the very same COVID-19. For the very first time, we saw Africans really working extremely hard, united, presenting a regional front in terms of buying of vaccines, speaking with one voice. I think there hasn't been any year that Africans spoke loudly in terms of demanding fairness at a global level and exposing the unfairness in which the continent is treated. We have also had a number of coups on the African continent this year, more than any other year in the recent past. And this was also followed by change of government, particularly in Zambia. We saw the coming of a new opposition leader taking power. And we also have had a continent that is moving forward on its infrastructure development,
right,
and more so in partnership with strategic partners. And of all partners, I think China has come out as the most important in terms of figure, the number of investments, the assistance and the donations, including the recent announced 1 billion vaccines, 600 million donations, and 400 jointly production with Africans. So these are some of the most important events in my view.
Professor Xia Lu, your thoughts?
Actually, when we look back 50 years ago in 1971, actually it was, or it were the African countries, the friendly countries that, you know, introduced the kind of resolution into the United Nations that restored the legal seat of the People's Republic of China ever since 1940s, the UN was established. So I would like to say that in the year 2021, this event marks the milestone between the relation between, between the relation, in the relation between China and the African continent. And the second, we also know that in early this month, there was a kind of a ministerial meeting between the African countries and China. That was a forum on the China-African cooperation. And this year's kind of the meeting focused on the strengthening or the improvement of rural area and also the poverty alleviation. So I would like to argue that the poverty alleviation would be the focus of the next couple of years between China and Africa.
Dr. Mustafa, your thoughts.
Thank you, Beatrice. This year, 2021, really was a mixed bag here in Africa. And some of the highlights, the good points is the in some areas there were, you know, increasing democratization processes in Southern Africa. You know, people electing their government. We saw an opposition party and a leader coming up to take to win the presidency in Zambia. So generally, more legitimacy in the democratic processes here. Multilaterally, we saw more multilateralism, China, Africa relations strengthening and focusing on what really matters in terms of building infrastructure and connecting the African continent so that there is increased trading between countries of Africa. These are some of the highlights. Of course, not forgetting that there was a robust engagement, mobilization to address COVID, which on the whole has not affected the African continent as much as it has affected Europe, for example, Latin America, in terms of health. However, the economy of African continent, even though there were these developments, positive developments, it was hard hit by COVID-19.
Dr. Nchenga, so let's look at this event that many have talked about that defined most of 2021, the COVID-19 pandemic and the vaccines. Now, according to the World Health Organization, Africa has fully vaccinated about 77 million people, just about 6% of its population. In comparison, over 70% of the high-income countries, you know, have been vaccinated. Why is the uptake in Africa so low?
In Africa, as of today, we've now vaccinated, when I mean vaccinated, fully vaccinated, which means for two doses, for those vaccines that need two doses, or for one dose for the vaccine that need only one dose, like Johnson & Johnson. So as of today, we've vaccinated 115 million people fully vaccinated, which represent about 8.4% of the population, the total African population. Now, that's one. The second one is, let us also not paint Africa in the whole one color as usual. Africa actually is many countries, and they are different, and they are at different level, even including in terms of vaccination. As we speak in Africa today, at least 26 countries, they've consumed more than 50% of the vaccine that they have, and that at least seven countries have completed more than 40% of fully vaccinated people, including some of the countries at more, even about 79% of fully vaccinated people. Now, that said, you're absolutely right. When we compare Africa as a whole and other region, yes, Africa has vaccinated less than other region. And there's a very clear reason about that.
Right.
The reasons, some of the reasons are the following. One, you might remember, Beatrice, that Africa, we started the latest. I mean, long later than other countries and other regions. That's one. Second, of course, is availability of vaccine. I started here by giving the number of vaccine that
right.
some of the countries or African countries have used. That said, is still true that African countries have not received the amount of the vaccine that is requested. And let us also be clear that we are still having, in some of our African countries, we are still struggling with operations or challenges.
All
That's
right.
also true. And of course, like in any other country, in any other region, we are also...
Welcome back. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. And that will conclude our program for today, Sunday, December 26, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. If you'd like to have access to today's program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. We're going to close out with a live concert from 1954 featuring jazz trumpeter Clifford Brown and jazz drummer Max Roach. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Presenting the outstanding exponents of the new jazz, led by Max Roach at the drums.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure to introduce to you at this time, George Bledsoe, our bass violinist. Our pianist, Carl Perkins. Teddy Edwards, our tenor saxophonist. And the great Clifford Brown on trumpet.
First, all God's children got rhythm.
Thank you. Now it's our pleasure to present Clifford Brown playing for you Tenderly.
Thank you.
A Teddy Edwards original, Sunset Eyes.